Ezra chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, the Lord stirred up in the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he sent a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and also put it in writing, saying, Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever there is among you, all of his people, may his God be with him. Let him go up into Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. Every survivor, at whatever place he may live, let the men of that place support him with silver and gold, with goods and cattle, together with a freewill offering for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. Again, that's Ezra chapter 1, verses 1 through 4.
Go up and build was what Cyrus was instructing the people of God to do. And as we look at this period of history, it's a fascinating period to me. Perhaps one of my favorite periods of Bible history to talk about, simply because it deals with the period of the punishment of God's people as they were taken away into captivity, and then as God had prophesied, they would be brought back into the land when they would repent of their sin. Now, Jeremiah, the Old Testament prophet, tells us in this period of time, as he speaks in chapter 25, or as we see him writing in chapter 25, reading beginning in verse 9. He said, Behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, saith Jehovah, and I will send unto Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and will bring them against this land and against the inhabitants thereof, and against all these nations round about, and I will utterly destroy them and make them an astonishment and a hissing and a perpetual desolation. Moreover, I will take from them the voice of myrrh and the voice of gladness and the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, the sound of the millstones and the light of the lamp, and this whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Beginning in verse 12, we see that number in particular repeated, that they would come out of captivity and be restored to the land that God had given unto them. Now, what makes this especially interesting to me is that which God had already told them. A number of passages, just to cite them, I'm not necessarily asking you to look all of them up, but in Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 25, Moses had told them before they ever went into the promised land, that when you worship idols, here's what will happen. And then in Deuteronomy chapter 8, he told them the same thing. In Deuteronomy chapter 29 through chapter 30, again he tells them that when you worship idols, this is the consequence. This is what's going to happen. You will be taken into captivity. Now in the text of Deuteronomy chapter 30, reading beginning at verse 3, it says that then Jehovah thy God will turn thy captivity and have compassion upon thee and will return and gather thee from all the peoples whither Jehovah thy God has scattered thee. In verse 8 through the remainder of that chapter, when they would return to God's law and keep the statutes and commandments, God then would allow them to be restored to the land. The interesting thing to me about this text is that Moses is telling them, here's what you will do, here's what God will do when you do this. And so we see the order of events set up for us. Now the chart that's on the board before you illustrates the kingdom, what is referred to as the United Kingdom, during the days of David and Solomon. Of course, that began during the days of King Saul. But the map we have on the board illustrates the kingdom united called Israel. But as a result of the idolatry of the northern 10 tribes, we read of the Assyrian threat to the northern 10 tribes, and then eventually the Assyrians conquer the northern 10 tribes. And left alone, there is Judah. Now, you've seen these maps before, and I think they preach a lesson in and of themselves just looking at the maps. You recall how that the Assyrian king came to Hezekiah, the king of Judah in the city of Jerusalem, made fun of him, saying, you're going to get all these folks killed. And of course,
during the reign of King Hezekiah, they were being faithful to God, and God spared the people of Judah because of their faith and confidence in Him. But then, as God had said, that the Assyrians would be conquered. And so it was. The great Babylonian kingdom conquered the Assyrian empire, and of course, the kingdom of Judah was taken captive, just as we've been reading in these texts. And after a period of 70 years, we note that the Medo-Persian empire came to the throne, or came to have a world empire conquering the Babylonians, and Cyrus came to the throne, and he wrote a decree allowing these people to go home. Now, when we read about the book of Haggai and Nehemiah, Haggai, who led in the building of the temple in the city of Jerusalem, as was read in your hearing a few moments ago from Ezra chapter 1, authority being given to him to do that. And then, of course, Nehemiah, who led in the rebuilding of the walls around the city of Jerusalem in 444 B.C. Now, the dates that you have on the handouts demonstrate what we have on the board, in fact, the same charts, to tell us when the first captives of Jerusalem were taken into Babylonian captivity. The second group taken in about 597, and then Jerusalem fell as Nebuchadnezzar the king destroyed that city in 586 B.C. In 539 B.C., Babylon fell, just as God had said that it would. And interestingly enough, I want to call your attention very briefly to a couple of the passages that we have on the board. One, of course, in Daniel chapter 5, beginning in verse 25, where Daniel says that the empire of Babylon is going to be destroyed. Daniel chapter 5, beginning in verse 25, there the text tells us, and this is the writing that was inscribed, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. It says, this is the interpretation of the thing, and of course, Mene, God hath numbered thy kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances and found wanting. Peres, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Interestingly enough, you'll note in verse 29, then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold about his neck and made proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. In that night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain, and Darius, the Mede, received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. And as we look at this, we see clearly that what God had said did indeed come to pass. Isaiah the prophet, prophesying just prior to this period of time, in Isaiah chapter 44 and on into chapter 45, had this to say. Isaiah chapter 44 and 45. Beginning in verse 27. And saith to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up thy rivers, that saith of Cyrus. He is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying of Jerusalem, she shall be built, and of the temple thy foundation shall be laid. Thus saith Jehovah to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings to open the doors before him, and the gates shall not be shut. Isaiah named the name of Cyrus, who would rule over the Persian Empire, the decree that he would make, interestingly enough, about 200 or so years before the Medo-Persian kingdom was even established, much less before Cyrus was even born. Now again, that's fascinating to me. But as we look at these dates, indeed, Cyrus issued the decree for these Jews to go back to the city of Jerusalem and rebuild after 70 years. We note that Nehemiah, in 444 B.C., returned to build the walls of the city. Now, I'm going to pass over. You have this in your notes. You do not have this in your notes. Pardon me? It did not print. Oh, okay. Well, then I need to talk about this briefly. I thought that it did. All right. Very good. These rulers over the period during the books of Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Now, that's interesting because it caps, puts all of these kings into one batch and tells us when these particular prophets prophesied. Cyrus, as we noted, conquered Babylon in 539 B.C. with Darius the Mede. Cambyses, pronounce these hopefully close to correct, also called Artaxerxes, commanded the work on the temple to cease. We could go back and talk about the whys and wherefores and discuss that. That's beyond our lesson this evening. Darius authorized the completion of the temple. We can read about that in Ezra 4. And the book of Haggai, for the most part, deals with that subject throughout. And the attitude of the people we'll note in just a bit. Xerxes, also called Ahasuerus. Esther, as we talked about a week or two ago, was the queen of this king of the Persian Empire. Artaxerxes authorized then Nehemiah return and rebuild the walls in the city of Jerusalem. And, of course, much of Ezra and the book of Nehemiah are committed to that very thing. Now, I want you to open your Bible, if you will, to the Old Testament book of Nehemiah. We're going to spend most of our time in our study tonight from this book. Nehemiah, as you know, I like to preach on Nehemiah. He is a man of action. He's not one to sit down and say, well, this needs to be done, but it's somebody else's job. Let them do it. Nehemiah was not one to say, this needs to be done, but I wish somebody would do it. Nehemiah was one who rose to the occasion and did what needed to be done. In Nehemiah chapter 1, in verse 2, we learn that Nehemiah raises the question about the condition of his brethren in the city of Jerusalem. The answer is given in verse 3. They said unto me, the remnant that are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. The condition of the city was not very good. And Nehemiah is touched by that. It bothers him. In verse 4, it came to pass, when I heard these words, that I sat down and wept and mourned certain days, and I fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Nehemiah is more than concerned. He's disturbed about the condition of the city of his father's sepulchers. He sat down, he mourned, he prayed. We note he also, in verse 11, prays for himself. I want to pick up the reading, if you would, beginning in verse 8. Verse 8 of chapter 1. He said, remember, I beseech thee, as he prays to God, remember, I beseech thee, the word that thou commandest thy servant Moses, saying, if ye trespass, I will scatter you abroad among the peoples. But if ye return unto me and keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts were in the uttermost part of the heavens, yet I will gather them from thence and will bring them unto the place that I have chosen to cause my name to dwell there. Now these are thy servants and thy people whom thou hast redeemed by thy great power and by thy strong hand. And then in verse 11, O Lord, I beseech thee, let now thine ear be attentive to the prayer of thy servant and to the prayer of thy servants who delight to fear thy name. And prosper, I pray thee, thy servant this day, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. It says, now I was cupbearer to the king. A lot of interesting things that we'll have to pass over for sake of time this evening. As Richard told me, I only have 45 minutes. But we notice in this text that Nehemiah prays that God would grant him favor in the sight of this king. I was cupbearer to the king. In chapter 2, in the first few verses, the king notices that when Nehemiah comes before him, his countenance is sad. And Nehemiah is asked by the king, verse 2, why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick? This is nothing else but sorrow of heart. Then he says, I was very sore afraid. Why do you suppose Nehemiah was afraid? Let's just suppose, for example's sake, that you have the honor of being cupbearer to the king. But even so, you are in a position of servitude. And you walk before the king, and the king notices something's wrong, and he says, what's wrong? I know something's wrong. Would you be afraid? Here's the most powerful man in the world asking you, why are you sad? And the text then tells us in verse 3, let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad when the city The place of my father's sepulchres lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire. Look at verse 4. Then the king said unto me, for what dost thou make request? Again he says, so I prayed to the God of heaven. Where would you be if the most powerful man in the world asked you what's wrong, and then you tell him what's bothering you? And the most powerful man in the world says to you, what can I do to help? Would you want to flippantly give an answer? Or would you want to pray and give the right answer? You see, Nehemiah prays that he might give the right answer, the answer that would be the most appropriate for the people of God. James speaks concerning the power of prayer, as he emphasizes that the prayer, the fervent prayer of a man of God, or the faithful prayer of a man of God, is indeed powerful. It can bring about results. It can change the mind of God. It can bestow favor upon those, just as Nehemiah has prayed for King Artaxerxes. Now look at verses 3 through verse 8. In verse 3 it says, verse 5, and I said unto the king, if it please the king, and if thy servant have found favor in thy sight, that thou wouldest send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build. Look at that carefully, brethren. Nehemiah says, send me. If you want to do something in favor of these people, you send me, and I'll go and I'll help them rebuild. Now, if you'll look at verse 6, the king said unto me, the queen also sitting by him, for how long shall thy journey be, and when wilt thou return? That's an important question we're going to come back to in chapter 13. How long you be gone? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Note, if you will, that Nehemiah has prayed that I might find favor in the eyes of this man. And now this man says, what can I do to help? And he says, send me. And the king says, how long you want to be gone? And then in verse 7, I said to the king, if it please the king, let letters be given me to the governors beyond the river, that they may let me pass through till I come unto Judah. And a letter unto Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the castle, which appertaineth to the house, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall enter unto. And the king granted him all of that. I want letters so that I can have the supplies, the materials, everything I need to do this. You see, Mr. King, send me. I'll go and I'll do the work. Now in chapter 2, beginning in verse 9 through the remainder of this chapter, again, for sake of time, we'll not take the time to read all of it, but Nehemiah comes to the city. And he looks around to see what kind of work needs to be done, knowing that the walls are in a state of desolation. The gates have been burned up. And so he looks to see what the work is. And then in verse 17, then said I unto them, ye see the evil case that we are in, how Jerusalem lieth waste, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Come and let us build up the walls of Jerusalem, that we be no more reproach. And I told them of the hand of my God, which was good upon me, as also of the king's words that he had spoken unto me. And they said, let us rise up and build. Look at that. Nehemiah has gotten a very favorable response from these people. Let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. Now, if the book ended right there, we might think good things are about to happen. But then we're introduced to three fellows, Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem. And when they heard of these things, it says, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, what is this thing that ye do? Will ye rebel against the king? I want to call your attention to verse 20 especially. It says, then I answered them and said unto them, the God of heaven, he will prosper us. Therefore we, his servants, will arise and build, but ye have no portion, nor right, nor memorial in Jerusalem. Now these who are the enemies of Nehemiah and the people of God, Nehemiah simply answers their ridicule, it's none of your business. It's just none of your business. We're going to rise up and build. Now as the text continues, let me go back on that chart. In chapter 3, as Nehemiah has looked around and seen what work needs to be done, There needs to be organization to the work. There's preparation to take place. So-and-so, you and your tribe or your family, you work on this portion of the wall. You and you and you work on this portion of the wall. You and your family will work on this gate. So we find that the announcement, or the assignments rather, are given for the work. Everybody knows their job. Now that ought to be impressive. That's a lesson in and of itself as well. Preparation has to take place. But look at the enthusiasm that results from Nehemiah's effort. But before we see the enthusiasm, let us look at Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem. In chapter 4, it says, "But it came to pass that when Sanballat heard that we were building the wall, he was wroth and took great indignation and mocked the Jews." He made fun of them. "And he spake before his brethren and the army of Samaria and said, 'What are these feeble Jews doing?'" Making fun of them. He said, "Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they make an end in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish, seeing they are burned?" They're going to build a wall out of these scraps. In verse 3, "Now Tobiah the Ammonite was by him, and he said, 'Even that which they are building, if a fox go up, he shall break down their stone wall.'" I would dare say most of you have seen a fox, not a very big animal. But his ridicule was, "Even if a fox goes up on that wall, it'll fall." Now that doesn't speak very well of his confidence in what the Jews are doing, does it? He's making fun of them. But in verse 4, again, Nehemiah prays, "Hear, O our God, for we are despised, and turn back their reproach upon their own head, and give them up for a spoil in the hand," or in the land rather, "of captivity." Drop down to verse 6. "So we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together, and to half the height thereof, for the people had a mind to work." Lots to be said on that. The people had a mind to work. You can take just a few people who have a mind to work, and you can accomplish a great task. Whereas you can take a multitude of people who want to be lazy and indifferent toward the work, and you can't accomplish anything. When you look at the book of Haggai, we see that demonstrated. Haggai came to the people to help them to rebuild the temple about 520 to 516 B.C. And look at what he found in the book of Haggai. It says, beginning in verse 2, "Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, saying, This people say, it is not the time for us to come, the time for Jehovah's house to be built. Then came the word of Jehovah by Haggai the prophet, saying, Is it a time for you yourselves to dwell in your sealed houses, while this house lieth waste? Now therefore, thus saith Jehovah of hosts, consider your ways." Sometimes we have to stop and think about what in the world we're doing. They had come back for the purpose of restoring the temple, restoring the walls, rebuilding the city, offering sacrifices in the temple. They were to restore things. And they had come and they had laid the foundation of the temple, but because of some opposition, they stopped working. And Haggai says, "What are you doing? You built your houses. What about the Lord's house? Consider your ways." Sometimes it's the Lord's house that gets neglected, isn't it? And yet we see that the people of Nehemiah's day had a mind to work. They're not indifferent toward this task of rebuilding the walls. In chapter 4, in verse 9, it says, "But we made a prayer unto," or made our prayer unto our God, "and set a watch against them day and night because of them." Notice again, Sanballat and Tobiah presenting themselves as enemies of the people of God. Dropping down once again into the text to verse 11, it says, "And our adversaries say, They shall not know, neither see, till we come into the midst of them and slay them and cause the work to cease." They needed a watch, did they not? Because the enemies have threatened them. But their plan is found out. And in verse 15, "It came to pass, when our enemies heard that it was known unto us, and God had brought their counsel to naught, that we returned all of us to the wall, every one unto his work." We see they're taking care of their assigned task. But they continued to have a mind to work. They returned to their work. In verse 16, It tells us, "And it came to pass from that time forth that half of my servants wrought in the work, and half of them held spears and shields and the bows and the coats of mail, and the rulers were behind all the house of Judah." They set a watch, an armed watch, where some could build and others could watch. And as you drop further down into the text, we note in verse 18 that the builders, everyone had his sword girded by his side, and so builded. "And he that sounded the trumpet was by me. And I said unto the nobles, and to the rulers, and to the rest of the people, the work is great and large, and we are separated upon the wall, one far from another. In what place soever ye hear the sound of the trumpet, resort ye hither. Unto us our God will fight for us." They had a big job. Their assignments were being carried out, but they were scattered. And with the threat of their enemies, it was necessary for them to hear the sound of the trumpet. The trumpet would give them orders. It had a very distinctive sound, and Nehemiah kept the trumpeter by him. And what the trumpeter said, they were to do to defend the work in which they were engaged. Nehemiah's confidence is in God. Our God will fight for us. Interesting to note that they worked with one hand and they held their weapon in the other hand, but they continued to work. They had a mind to work. Now in the fifth chapter, it says, "Then there arose a great cry of the people and of their wives against their brethren, the Jews." What's wrong? It says, "For there were that said, we, our sons, and our daughters are many. Let us get grain that we may eat and live. Some also there were that said, we are mortgaging our fields and our vineyards and our houses. Let us get grain because of the dearth or drought. There were also that said, we have borrowed money for the king's tribute upon our fields and our vineyards. Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children. And lo, we bring into bondage our sons and our daughters to be servants, and some of our daughters are brought into bondage already. Neither is it in our power to help it, for other men have our fields and our vineyards." What's taking place? Well, we've got a problem of taxation. We've got a problem of borrowing money for food. We've got a problem of borrowing money for mortgages. And so consequently, when you take out a mortgage, you put up collateral. And that's what they did. And they put up their fields. They put up their vineyards. And they lost them. They put up their sons and daughters to become servants in somebody else's houses. And they lost them. And so now we've got a problem among the Israelites. Where is the problem? The problem is not from Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem. The problem is them. The problem is among them. If you look at the text of chapter 5, in verse 6, Nehemiah says, "I was very angry when I heard their cry and these words. Then I consulted with myself, and contended with the nobles and the rulers, and said unto them, ye exact usury, every one of his brother. And I held a great assembly against them." In verse 9, it tells us, "The thing that you do is not good." Not good. Well, what were they doing? They were selling each other, much like the heathen nations that had taken them captive. And they had been able to buy their brethren to come back into the land, and now they're selling one another to each other for the high interest on the mortgages, the high interest on the money that had been borrowed to pay taxes. And so now their sons and their daughters belong to somebody else. And Nehemiah was angry. He says, "It's not good." And when he rebuked them in the latter part of verse 8, it says, "Then held they their peace and found never a word." I like that expression. When Nehemiah rebuked them, there wasn't anything to say. They were wrong. And Nehemiah calls upon the people to stop that. And in verse 12, it says, "Then said they, we will restore them and will require nothing of them. So will we do, even as thou sayest. Then I called the priest and took an oath of them that they would do according to this promise." You've got to do this. Stop the high interest. stop the mortgaging. Stop the sons and the daughters being sold. Give that all back. And they did. They promised. And an oath was taken. Now Nehemiah says, I am the king's governor. I've been sent here to lead in the rebuilding of the walls. Consequently, I am to receive a governor's portion from the king. But he said, I've not used it selfishly like you have. I'm to receive a governor's portion of food, but I've not used it like you have. He used it to supply the needs of those Jews who were there rebuilding the walls. Nehemiah sets before them an example in verse 8 or 18. He said, now that which was prepared for one day was one oxen and six choice sheep. Also fowls were prepared for me, and once in 10 days stores of all sorts of wine. Yet for all this I demanded not the bread of the governor, because the bondage was heavy upon this people. The people are suffering. Wouldn't be right, you see, to receive all of those blessings from the king and use that selfishly. Now you would think things are really good. He's got the people to straighten up. They're being fed and cared for. Their children are restored. Everything's great. Well, not quite yet. When we look at the 6th chapter, again we read concerning Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem. They want the work to stop. Now, if you can get the fellow who is the leader in the work away from the work, what's likely to happen to the people? Well, they'll become disorganized. They'll become lazy and indifferent. And the work will stop. Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, they know that. And if you'll note in verse 2, it said that Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, come, let us meet together in one of the villages in the plain of Ono. But they sought to do me mischief. Well, Nehemiah's no dummy. He knows what their intentions are, to get him away from the work. And he said, I am doing a great work. I cannot come. You ever tell somebody, I can't do what you want me to do because I'm doing this. Can't do it. This is more important. I'm doing a great work. Nehemiah was not about to go down to the plains of Ono, where he knew they sought to get him to compromise when he was rebuilding or leading the people in the rebuilding of the walls around the city of Jerusalem. They sent messages to him 5 times, and he would not go. And then you'll note, beginning in verse 10. Verse 10. And I went to the house of Shemaiah, the son of Delaiah, the son of, and I'm not going to try to pronounce that, who was shut up, and he said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us shut the doors of the temple, for they will come to slay thee. Yea, in the night they will come to slay thee. Now that makes Shemaiah sound like a real nice guy, doesn't it? He is a prophet. He's instructing Nehemiah, come into the temple because the enemies are seeking to kill you. But in verse 11, and I said, should such a man as I flee? And who is there that, being such as I, would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. And I discerned, and lo, God had not sent him, but he pronounced this prophecy against me, and Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. That's interesting, isn't it? He's placed himself in alliance to kill Nehemiah. The enemies have hired him to get him away from the work so that he can be killed under the guise of saying, well, we're going to protect you inside the temple. What deceit. No, he was not a friend to Nehemiah. In verse 14, the text tells us, remember, O my God, Tobiah, Sanballat, according to these works, these their works. And, of course, in verse 15, the wall continued. It was finished in the 25th day of the month Elul in 52 days. Now, 52 days. I would challenge you to look on a website and find the length, the size of this wall. And then just put your mind to work at how long it would take you to build such a wall. They built it in 52 days because they had a mind to work. These people were busy. Now, in the 7th chapter, we note that it was needful to register the people, needful to know the lineage, the genealogies, who would receive this or that, and who would do this job or that. So they were called in, and they were listed according to the genealogies in their return from the captivity of Babylon. But now these people need to be educated. They've not heard the law read in a very long time. And so in the 8th chapter, Ezra, the scribe, in verse 1, took the book of the law of Moses, it tells us, which Jehovah had commanded to Israel, and he brought the book of the law before the people. And dropping down into the text, in verse 3, he read therein before the broad place that was before the water gate, from early morning until midday, in the presence of the men and the women and of those that could understand. And the ears of all the people were attentive unto the book of the law, and Ezra the scribe stood upon a pulpit of wood. And in verse 5, he opened the book in the sight of all the people, for he was above all the people. And when he opened it, all the people stood up. How long did Ezra read? From early morning till midday. When he opened the book, what did the people do? They stood up. What does that suggest to you? They weren't standing up, stretched their legs, Richard. They were standing up out of reverence and respect for what they were hearing, the Word of God. And they stood up from early morning till midday. Now, when they heard the law read, that exacted from them a response. You see, they've not heard it in a very long time. And when they heard it read, verse 10 tells us, verse 9. And Nehemiah, who was the governor, and Ezra the priest, the scribe, and the Levites that taught the people, said unto all the people, this day is holy unto Jehovah your God. Mourn not, nor weep, for all the people wept when they heard the words of the law. Why do you suppose they're so sad? Well, they're learning that there's a whole lot of things that they're doing that they ought not be doing. And a whole lot of things that they ought to be doing that they're not doing. And they learn that in the reading of the law. Now, when we come to the 9th chapter, what takes place? It says, now, in the 24th day of this month, the children of Israel were assembled with fasting and with sackcloth and earth upon them, and the seed of Israel separated them from all foreigners, and stood and confessed their sins and the iniquities of their fathers. And they stood up in their place and read in the book of the law of Jehovah their God a fourth part of the day, and another fourth part they confessed and worshipped Jehovah their God. Well, they learned some things that have to be corrected. Now, in the list of the things that have to be corrected, what are some of them? Well, as we go back to the book of Ezra, in chapters 9 and chapter 10, Ezra had addressed the subject of marrying these who were of heathen nationalities that they were not to be married to. And in chapter 9 and chapter 10, we see the sorrow of the people being expressed for what they've done. Somebody said, well, isn't being sorry enough? No. No, it was not enough. They had married women that God had said not to marry. What do they do about it? Well, if you'll note, beginning in verse 1 of chapter 10, Ezra, it says, while Ezra prayed and made confession and weeping and casting himself down before the house of God, there was gathered together unto him out of Israel a very great assembly of men and women and children, for the people wept very sore. What's the problem? They've learned some things, and they've learned things about their marriages that have to be corrected. And in verse 3, now therefore let us make a covenant with our God to put away all the wives and such as are born of them, according to the counsel of my Lord and of those that tremble at the commandment of our God, and let it be done according to the law. Ezra wept in verse 6. He was not happy about this information. It broke his heart. We note that there were those who had children, and these were affected. Their wives were affected. It was not a happy day. And when they made confession of their sins, it exacted from them much mourning. But then in the 10th chapter, going back to the book of Nehemiah, it says in chapter 10, in verse 29, and they clave to their brethren, their nobles, and entered into a curse, and into an oath to walk in God's law, which was given by Moses, the servant of God, to observe and do all the commandments of Jehovah our Lord, and his ordinances and his statutes, and that we would not give our daughters unto the peoples of the land, nor take their daughters for our sons. And if the peoples of the land bring wares or any grain on the Sabbath day to sell, that we would not buy them on the Sabbath or on a holy day, and that we would forego the seventh year and the exaction of every debt. I want you to remember those verses, because these are verses that they promise we will do this and we will not do this. And we're going to see just how faithful they were to their promise. You know, we need to do what we promise we'll do. But perhaps you have the idea they didn't, and they didn't. But they make a covenant, a promise, we're going to keep the law. Well, once the city has been structured and the walls around the city are completed, it's time to populate the city. Who's going to dwell in the city? Chapter 11 discusses that, and we note that one out of every 10 was to live within the walls of the city. Now that brings us quickly to chapter 12. In chapter 12, beginning at verse 27, it tells us, "And at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought the Levites out of all their places to bring them to Jerusalem to keep the dedication with gladness, both with thanksgiving and with singing and with cymbals and psaltery and with harps." It's a great day. The walls have been completed. The people have been restored to their faithfulness to the law. It's time to celebrate. And so they do. And they bring in the priest, the musical instruments. The people have occasion to be happy and rejoice. And in verse 43, it tells us they offered great sacrifices that day and rejoiced, for God had made them rejoice with great joy, and the women also and the children rejoiced, so that the joy of Jerusalem was heard even afar off. It's a great day in Jerusalem. Everything seems to be great, doesn't it? The purpose for which Nehemiah has come has been fulfilled. If we could stop right there, it would be a pretty picture. But we have chapter 13. And chapter 13 presents a problem. Chapter 13. I've used the expression, when the cat is away, the mice will play. You remember back over in the second chapter, when the king asked Nehemiah, "How long will you be gone?" And Nehemiah set him a date, set him a time. Well, the time has expired, and Nehemiah has to go back to the king and renew his leave. And in chapter 13, in verse 4, it tells us, "Now before this Elisha, the priest," we know from the next chapter, or for the latter part of this chapter rather, that he was a high priest, verse 28. "Now before this Elisha, the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of our God, being allied unto Tobiah," flag goes up. Who's Tobiah? He's one of the enemies of God's people, right along with Sanballat and Geshem. Tobiah. "And now we find that Elisha, the high priest, has become an ally to Tobiah." What's he done? Verse 5. "He had prepared for him a great chamber, where aforetime they laid the meal offerings and the frankincense and the vessels and the tithes of the grain and the new wine and the oil, which were given by commandment to the Levites and the singers and the porters and the heave offerings for the priest. But in all this time I was not at Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I went unto the king, and after certain days asked I leave of the king." Asked to go home. And the high priest has made a dwelling place for Tobiah. Where did he make it? It tells us that this room that was used, it was used for those things that would supply the needs of the priest and the sacrifices that they were to offer. Well, then, what does that do for the priest? We'll talk about that. Look, if you will, at verse 7. It says, "And I came to Jerusalem and understood the evil that Elisha had done for Tobiah in preparing him a chamber in the courts of the house of God. and it grieved me sore. Therefore, I cast forth all the household stuff of Tobiah out of the chamber. Then I commanded that they cleanse the chamber, and thither brought I again the vessels of the house of God with the meal offerings and the frankincense. You see, Nehemiah was so upset of this occasion that he took those possessions of Tobiah and threw them out. Now, that's one way to clean the house, isn't it? He threw them out. And he commanded that the courts be cleansed and that these offerings and the things needful for the priest be restored. Well, now, as the priest have had their supplies taken from them to benefit Tobiah, the priests have left their function and they're in the fields working. In verse 10. And I perceived that the portions of the Levites had not been given them, so that the Levites and the singers that did the work were fled every one to his field. Then contended I with the rulers and said, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together and set them in their place. Nehemiah is not happy. Look at what the people are doing. The Levites, they can't do their work because Shemaiah or Elishab has prepared a place for Tobiah in the house of God. And then in chapter 13, verse 15 beginning, it says, in those days saw I in Judah, some men treading wine presses on the Sabbath, and bringing in sheaves and lading asses therewith, and as also wine, grapes, and figs, and all manner of burdens, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath days, or Sabbath day, and I testified against them in the day wherein they sold victuals. What are we looking at? Why, they're buying and selling on the Sabbath day. Hold that thought. Verse 16. There dwelt men of Tyre also therein, who brought in fish and all manner of wares, and sold on the Sabbath unto the children of Judah and in Jerusalem. Then I contended with the nobles of Judah, and said unto them, what evil thing is this that ye do and profane the Sabbath day? Didn't you promise that you wouldn't do that back over there in chapter 10? Didn't you promise that you would not profane the Sabbath day, that you would not buy wares on the Sabbath? Didn't you promise that you would keep the law? Well, of course they did, but they're not doing that now, are they? And when Nehemiah sees what they are doing, he commands that the gates of the city be closed. And what do the merchants do? They set up camp just outside the gates. And Nehemiah, it tells us in verse 20, so the merchants and sellers of all kinds of wares lodged without Jerusalem once or twice. Then I testified against them and said unto them, why lodge ye about the wall? If you do so again, I will lay hands on you. Now, friend, he's not intending to treat them kindly. So they left. They left. But that's not all of the problems. In verse 23, it says, in those days, also I saw Jews that had married women of Ashdod and Ammon and Moab. And their children spake half the speech of Ashdod and could not speak in the Jews' language, but according to the language of each people. What does that tell us they did? You see, in Ezra chapter 9 and chapter 10, they've understood what they did was wrong and intermarrying with these heathen nations, and they determined we can't continue that. We must separate ourselves from that. But now while Nehemiah has gone back to renew his leave, they've done the very thing that they promised they would not do. And in verse 25, I continued with them and cursed them and smote certain of them and plucked off their hair and made them swear by God, saying, ye shall not give your daughters unto their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or for yourselves. And then he cites what Solomon did and the consequences that were imposed because of what Solomon did. An interesting contrast just here is how we deal with things. Carolyn and I were talking about this just earlier this morning, how that Ezra was dealing with the same issue. And when he saw what the people were doing, he sat down and pulled his beard out, confounded, the text tells us. Nehemiah didn't sit down. He wasn't confounded. And he didn't pull his beard out. What Nehemiah did, he was a man of action. He was one who was up, and he pulled their hair out, and he made them promise not to do this. Different people sometimes behave in different ways. Now, the lesson that I want you to take home tonight is we should be like Nehemiah. Nehemiah had an attitude that we need to emulate. His attitude was, let's get the work done. Let's develop a mind to work. Let's despise internal strife. See, the things that get us upset with each other, we're not going to allow that to become a distraction to our work. Now, friends, Satan's no dummy. He knows that if he can get us distracted, he's got us. And sometimes we fail to stay as focused on the work at hand as we need to be. And we allow other things to become a distraction. We must learn to accept the example and zeal of Nehemiah. You know, Nehemiah makes this statement, "Remember me, O my God," a number of times throughout this book. But as he closes this book, he says, "Remember me, O my God, for good." And Nehemiah has done a lot of things to help these people, to correct things. And no doubt some of the things that he did, they didn't like. But they were good. They were things that were recognized by both Nehemiah and God. These things were good. We need more folks like Nehemiah. I know some of you young folks have been studying about Nehemiah and Ezra and this time period. A fascinating time period. No doubt you're going to, if you haven't already, studied about Haggai. And we may have to talk a little bit about Haggai as we get a little bit farther down the road. An interesting period, the period of the restoration of Israel. You've listened patiently. Perhaps we've been edified by something about the study of Nehemiah that will help us to be stronger as we face those things that are wrong. Some of you perhaps are not Christians. You need to do something about that. If you're going to serve the Lord and be faithful to Him, you've got to become a Christian. Be forgiven of past sins. Believe that He is the Christ. Turn from those things. Repent of them. Confess your faith and be baptized. For the remission of your sins, you can enter into a new relationship with Him that's described as a new creature. Maybe you've done that. And like the people of Israel, you've made promises that you didn't keep. You need to fix that. The time and opportunity to do that is now. If you be subject to the invitation, make it known if you would, while together we stand and sing this song.